You're listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
What do Pets.com, housing tracks in Florida, 1980s Japan, and even the tulip bulb all have in common? They've all been the cause of economic bubbles. Speculative excess can make fortunes in the short run and then ruin whole economies when the enterprise goes bust. But is there any way to actually identify whether a boom will go bust before it happens? Vikram Mancharamani is a lecturer at Yale University and a global equity investor. He was on our show in April to discuss his latest book, Boom Bustology, Spotting Financial Bubbles Before They Burst. And we thought we would air that conversation for you again as we start this long holiday weekend. I began by asking, how long have economic bubbles been a fact of economic human life?
Forever, Leonard, I think is the right answer to that question. As far back as we have data, we've seen...
Mesopotamia, there were economic bubbles?
Well, we see some in the Roman era, yeah. I mean, we've seen some that go back in time. So they have varied, but they have been around for a while.
And what did the Romans have? It couldn't have been housing.
Well, there were all sorts of assets. And if you think about anything that has a price as being something that can be manipulated, hoarded, purchased, and sold, there's high likelihood of bubbles occurring really in anything.
But you say that we are in a period of acceleration of boom-bust cycles. What do you think is contributing to that?
I think there's a lot of reasons why that's happening. Unfortunately, I lay the blame for the acceleration in the cycles with some of our regulators and some of our government officials. In particular, I think the last several booms and busts that have transpired have all been linked. And so one can draw a connection between the implosion of the Japanese bubble, the outflow of capital from Japan into East Asia, the East Asian crisis that then resulted in the threat to financial systems around the world, including large hedge funds such as long-term capital management, the U.S. government, in particular the Federal Reserve, lowering rate to provide liquidity to offset some of that crisis, that resulting in the upward surge in the internet bubble, that collapsing, resulting in a newfound lowering of interest rates to produce the housing bubble, that collapsing and lowering rates to even lower rates today, that will create another bubble.
And you'd think that somebody would have figured out that one was going to lead to the other. And some people actually did, but they were just dismissed as Cassandras. Why?
I think we want to believe that we are able to manage these cycles more efficiently and more productively than we actually are.
Are they accelerating in severity as well as frequency?
They are. It's my opinion, Leonard, that they are. And I think part of that is something I called the drug dealer problem. And that is, we are addicted to debt. And this cycle is always solved by providing more debt. And so what we're ultimately doing is creating a situation that is highly unsustainable.
Well, right now, there has been a push to cut down on the amount of debt people can have. And the banks have been pushing right back, and it looks like they're going to win. So are we not learning anything from what just happened?
Well, I think what we find is that it's a lot easier to think about pain in the future than it is to accept pain today.
Must all booms be followed by a bust?
Well, it's a semantic question to some extent. If it doesn't bust, is it a boom or is it just simply sustainable growth? Mm-hmm. There are plenty of examples through history where we've had sustainable growth that results in improving values and higher prices, et cetera. So the answer is I guess they don't need to necessarily bust.
But we saw long sustainable growth, let's say, from the end of the 19th century into the 20th century. Would the Depression have been a bust or would that have been something else?
Yeah, so the Great Depression actually created, I think, what was one of the lenses I present in my book is an epidemic lens to gauge where you are in the relative cycle of a boom-bust sequence. And I use the analogy of a speculative fever spreading through a population the way a disease might. And I say, well, one of the things that you should be concerned about is when there are fewer and fewer people left to infect. Well, one thing that happened in the Great Depression during that bust was everyone was infected. And so you can think about it as the population was immunized, if not inoculated, from their speculative tendencies. And so we had a long period of time where speculative excess was offset by more of fear than it was greed.
And we're talking about everybody getting involved. You're stupid if you didn't get involved in it.
That's usually an example of a late-stage phenomenon, right? When your taxi driver's talking to you about internet stocks or the cocktail party conversation talks about how someone made millions trading condos, that's not exactly an early-stage phenomenon.
When you talk about debt being a major problem, addiction to debt, are you talking about personal debt or government debt?
Well, it's always been a problem at the individual level for some people, right? So that's not as concerning. What's concerning is when it happens in a systemic basis, and that could be throughout a population of individuals or it could be at a government level. So my argument really is based upon what happens over time. And so again, another lens that I present in this book, Leonard, is how capital structures evolve over time. We can think about a capital structure and how someone purchases a home. So initially, someone may purchase a home saying, I'm going to use my income to pay both interest and principal on that mortgage payment. Over time, they gain in confidence. Housing prices have risen. They say, you know what? I'm going to buy more home because houses go up, and I'm just going to pay the interest on this mortgage. I'm going to go to an interest-only mortgage. And then that works so well, and housing prices continue to rise so rapidly that the next step is I'm not going to be able to pay the entire interest bill. I'll pay some. We'll capitalize the interest. Well, that's actually the evolution of capital structure at an individual level that creates a lot of instability.
And it wasn't just greed being a factor. People were being told on television shows that this was the way that things should be done, that this could be your source of income and you didn't have to go out and get a regular job.
Sure. There's always the snake oil salesman, so to say, visible at peaks.
Free money.
Free money. That's right. My particular favorite example when it came to the television shows you're referencing was the competition of Flip This House against another television show called Flip That House.
Mm-hmm.
Housing became a national preoccupation.
My guest is Vikram Mancharamani. His book, Boom Bustology, Spotting Financial Bubbles Before They Burst. It is published by Wiley. And you open your preface by asking, is there a bubble in boom bust books? So can any object be a subject to a bubble?
Like I said, I think it has to do with things that are priced. Things that are generally not priced generally are less prone to these.
Well, books are priced, aren't they?
Sure. And indeed, I think there can be a bubble in books.
And there was a bubble in tulips, probably one of the most famous bubbles in the 1600s called Tulip Mania Now.
That's right.
What happened there? Is that classic?
Sure.
Is that something we'd recognize today?
I think we would. I mean, really what happened back in the 1600s was a remarkable sequence of events coming together. Number one, the Dutch had just beaten the Spaniards for independence in a military success. Number two.
So there was optimism.
There was optimism. Amsterdam was the de facto financial center of the world at the time. And so there was a belief that not only is our market supported by our local buyers, but buyers from all over the world will come here to buy our famous tulips. By the way, interestingly, tulips are not even native to Western Europe. They came from Turkey in the late 1500s. Nevertheless, there was amazing optimism. There was also financial innovation where we were able to embed leverage into these contracts. Because tulip bulbs are in the ground most of the year, you can't actually trade them, right? So what you've done is you created derivative contracts, some of the first derivative contracts really, where people could agree to buy something in the future at a certain price today. So you make the agreement today, the bulb gets delivered in the future. However, you never put up the full capital today. You put up the capital upon delivery. Well, what that does is it's basically embedded leverage in the system. And so we created systemic risk with these types of contracts.
We have to assume that when the bulbs finally come out of the ground, that they're going to sell for the price that we imagined or more.
That was the basis of the thinking back then.
And some people were selling their property. They put their entire fortunes into tulip bulbs.
Indeed they did. We have stories of great excess, people selling homes, all their livestock, and all their worldly possessions to buy a handful of tulips.
So tulips were the IT companies of their day?
Yeah, they were definitely the dot-com. Well, the interesting thing is there's always a belief during these speculative manias of it's different this time. And so, indeed, the tulips were relatively different. And so people combined that with the national overconfidence, perhaps, to say that it was a different era.
200 years later, we're talking now 1800s, Charles Mackay described tulip mania in his book, Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. And he wrote that after the tulip bust, quote, defaulters were announced day after day in all of the towns of Holland, hundreds who a few months previously had begun to doubt that there was such a thing as poverty in the land suddenly found themselves possessors of a few bulbs, which nobody would buy. So the value of everything in life seems arbitrary and dependent on taste. And what separates a tulip bulb from anything else that we claim has value?
That's a very deep philosophical question, I think. I think that there usually are some dynamics that set the price at a level where we can agree there's a market, so to say. So usually it's supply and demand that results in a reasonable price.
But wouldn't that work in housing? After all, there are still, sure, for example, in New York, there are still a lot more people who want
to be here,
to be here than we have housing.
Sure. And the traditional economic lens, which I take issue with, would say, well, it's priced at a point where the supply is going to equal the demand. And if there's more people that want to be here than can be here, then prices will rise. And we will get to a point where the people who want to be here, can afford to be here, and that'll be the number of houses that are actually here. Well, one of the lenses, another lens that I use in the book, which I think actually helps address your question here, Leonard, is what happens when higher prices result in more demand, not more supply, or lower prices result in more supply, not demand? Well, now this general concept of equilibrium that has so dominated economic thinking for a long time is irrelevant.
Did that not occur to people in the past?
What's that? The equilibrium concept?
Suggesting now.
Yeah, I mean, I think
– It must have happened before.
It happens during most of these speculative manias with quite regular consistency.
So, Mackay also wrote of the tulip bubble that the few who had contrived to enrich themselves hid their wealth from the knowledge of their fellow citizens and invested it in the English and other funds, which is similar to what we saw recently from people who profited from the housing bubble. So I guess people pretty much see the same opportunity again and again.
Yeah, well, what ends up happening during these speculative manias is as prices rise, those who got in early and who have identified these dynamics exit. And it increasingly gets dominated, the asset class that's in a bubble format, gets increasingly dominated by amateur investors. Back in the internet era, you might have called them day traders. In the housing era, you might have called them house flippers or condo flippers. And so at that point, you really have a lot of amateurs. The professionals have usually exited.
Mm-hmm.
And then redeploying capital to other areas.
And so the amateurs are the ones who screw it up, or they're the ones who just come in after the game is over?
Well, usually they're not exactly a first or second inning sort of participant. They tend to arrive after the seventh inning stretch.
And like many relief pitchers, they blow the save. Vikram Mancharamani has written a book called Boombustology, Spotting Financial Bubbles Before They Burst. It's published by Wiley. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Vikram Mancharamani, who was on the show in April to discuss his book, Boombustology, Spotting Financial Bubbles Before They Burst. I opened the second part of our conversation by asking him, how does a modern bubble typically get started?
Well, Leonard, oftentimes these bubbles come about because there's something that's new. There's a belief, a confidence, perhaps even a technology. So if we go back through time, there's always something that's new that spurs it.
And usually it's a good idea, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, owning a home is a good idea. And then there was faith in the idea that the housing market would never go down because people would constantly be coming into the market and want to get their own homes.
Sure. And the other thing we have is often in this idea of technology and innovation, it may have taken place in the financial sphere. So we had a lot of financial innovation that enabled greater access to mortgage products, et cetera. So that might have been part of the new thing this time around.
But aren't there people who extrapolate some crazy ideas from past economic experience? The housing market has never gone down, therefore it never can go down.
It's amazing. But yes, they do. I think the nuances are actually matter a little bit here. The housing markets, I think the belief when that was a common statement, 2005, 2006, 2007, was the housing markets in the nation sort of on average never go down. And sure, you might get a boom or bust cycle in a particular region. We've seen that through history many times. The argument, I don't buy it, but the argument made at the time was that the whole nation, you couldn't have average housing prices fall.
Well, there's also the whole matter of jumping on an investment bandwagon if our peers are already doing it.
It's amazing. The social pressure that drives one to do things that they otherwise shouldn't do and they intellectually know they shouldn't do. It's very hard to be a contrarian during these things, Leonard. And I would say the one thing that really matters is these new stories, these technologies, this innovation, this new era belief usually has a great believability to it. I mean, the truth is, you know, in the 1920s, we did invent cars that were becoming mass-produced. That was a great innovation that changed the way we worked.
There was a lot of optimism. Lindbergh was flying across the Atlantic.
We had, exactly, aerospace. We had radio, mass communication. This was a new era. Indeed, it was. However, investors tend to over-extrapolate that new era thinking into valuing it ahead of what it's probably worth.
So should we just follow the Groucho Marx line that we won't belong to any club that will have us as a member?
I think there's a huge value in a contrarian instinct when trying to navigate these booms and busts. If it's the popular flavor of the day, chances are it's not an early inning phenomenon.
But then people say you're just a pessimist.
That's the risk. That's the risk. You will likely miss gains in that approach. What you will hopefully do is avoid losses.
Yeah. Well, there are those people who are kicking themselves that they didn't buy that apartment or that house for $40,000 in 1968 that then later sold for $2 million.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Although I would tell you, in 1968, there were very few signs that we had a housing bubble on our hands. So you should have bought it.
Does modern economics, as it's taught in most college classrooms, focus on identifying the large trends that contribute to booms
and
busts?
Yeah, I mean, look, the education system in our country, and I think it's hard to generalize, but I will generalize. I think, unfortunately, the education approach that's been manifested in the economics departments tends to focus on this concept of equilibrium, broadly defined. Supply and demand equals a set price and doesn't think about the massive movements that go to extremes from there.
But then we also have economists in government like Alan Greenspan who are part of the whole promotion of these things. In fact, Wall Street and the U.S. government promoted home ownership, which struck most of us as a pretty good idea at the time.
Sure, sure. And there's nothing wrong with home ownership. I think the problem is when we subsidize it through various forms and tax breaks such that we enable participants in the market that shouldn't otherwise be in the market, so to say. One of the things in terms of education and thinking about these massive extremes that I think is very important and is a premise of the book that I've written is we need to take a multidisciplinary approach to thinking about these things. So it's not enough to just take an economic perspective to the matter. You have to look at it through a psychological lens of greed and fear and overconfidence and other psychological issues. You should look at the politics. Think about what the governments have done, what the incentives they put in place are. Are they creating any sense of moral hazard? And finally, we should look from a sort of sociological perspective of amateur investor participation.
Did something similar happen in the 20s with the Florida land bust?
The Florida land boom is a great example of something that did virtually identical. Here was a belief that housing prices were going to skyrocket. It was a very localized bubble in just Florida. It was driven by the belief that, wow, these Northeasterners with all this money could drive to Florida now that these cars and roads were in existence. The weather was great. It was going to be paradise in America. And so housing prices got bit up by a national mania that came with buyers from all over the country to Florida.
But they didn't have some of the things that we saw in the more recent boom. Other financial products connected to housing, like mortgage-backed securities, grew tremendously. Some cases, the products were given much higher ratings from agencies than they deserved. In some respects, we can say bubbles can be fueled by criminality or at least a degree of dishonesty, or is it just mass delusion?
You know, it's interesting. First of all, the analogies with what happened in Florida are actually more apt than you might otherwise think.
They were doing all of those things.
Let me give you some examples that I think have some relevance. Number one, They were binder contracts. People would buy land based upon looking at a map, and they'd put a certain percent down to control that. So that was basically like an option contract to buy, similar to what we saw in the Tulip era in terms of not putting the full value down. Number two, banks, because most banks were chartered at the state level, and because of the criminality you're discussing, prohibition was alive and well. And so the Florida borders, because of the Caribbean markets, were actually quite porous. And so we had a lot of money flowing into Florida banks. Florida banks could only lend in Florida. That's how they were chartered. And so they were willing to lend large sums of money to the real estate market.
It was like money laundering.
Almost. That's right.
So they had all this money.
They had to put it to work. And here's a great place to put it.
So what brought it down?
Ultimately, it was a couple of different things, including quite literally two hurricanes that hit Florida. But ultimately, what ends up happening in these things, in these bubbles, is they just lose their sustainability. It starts to crack, and then it just falls off an edge.
Well, some speculators recognize that certain things are bubbles and actually wind up profiting from them. And it's been pointed out that in 1929, the day of the big crash, there were people who actually made a lot of money. And there are people who made a lot of money from all of these recent bubbles bursting as well.
Sure. There will always be people that take the other side. I think they are fewer and far further between than we think.
It seems to me that if you're smart, you'll always bet against the bubble. Although we're not calling it a bubble, right, at the time.
Sure. That's the problem, right?
So what, like gold today, for example, is that a bubble?
Well, what I would do is I would say these are all probabilistic questions, Leonard, right? We're trying to gauge the probability that it's in a bubble. And I would say let's just apply the five lenses I talk about in my book to the subject of gold and determine whether we think it's bubbly or not. Number one, do we have those price dynamics I talked to you about where we have higher prices resulting in more demand? And yes, we do. Number two, has there been any financial innovation that's embedding leverage? Well, I hear constantly about the gold ETF, the gold double ETF, triple ETF, et cetera. So we're seeing some of that embedded leverage coming.
What does ETF mean?
Exchange-traded fund. Mm-hmm. So these are the products that allow retail investors or institutional investors to buy physical gold, not gold companies. Number three, are we having a belief that gold is a store of value and won't go down? Well, in fact, we do. So that makes three concerning things. Is there political manipulation? Here I have to take pause and say I'm not a conspiracy theorist that believes the government is manipulating gold supplies. So I would say no, we don't have that warning flag. And then the last one is, are we seeing amateur investors involved? And here, walking down the streets of New York, you can easily be offered money for your gold. You can buy gold, or as a host of another show indicated to me, they'll just take your gold.
My guest is Vikram Mancharamani, who is a global equity investor, lecturer at Yale University, where he teaches a seminar called Financial Booms and Busts, and now he's written a book called Boom Bustology, Spotting Financial Bubbles Before They Burst. It is published by Wiley. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You said that there was no political manipulation, but it has become a political thing because many of the people who are pushing gold are people like Ron Paul and Glenn Beck, and that's because they are also talking about mistrust of government institutions, gold being one of the few things that you can really trust. But weren't there gold busts in the past?
There are. What I would say is the one argument that tends to hold water with intellectuals about gold is it is the anti-money. It is the belief that the dollar will be devalued. You can print more dollars. You can't make more gold. However, my argument in return to that is very simple, that all of these things are based on faith, all forms of currency. It is the faith that someone will accept it and give me something of value for that. That is as true for the dollar bills in my pocket as it would be for the shiny rock if I were carrying it.
Does the government have or Wall Street have any interest in preventing the next bubble?
Do they have an interest? It's an interesting question, Leonard. I think that –
because it does have – has a lot of repercussions, and the role of government, I guess, through regulation is to prevent it. Sure. But we've seen Democrats and Republicans both do everything possible to prevent regulation over the years.
Sure. What it reminds me of, your question, is a bumper sticker that was quite prevalent, I think, around 2001, 2002, 2003 in California in the Silicon Valley area. And it was, please God, another bubble. there is a desire and there's a political manipulation, perhaps, to reinflate them when they bust. And that means there's this upward pressure until you can no longer do that. And that day of reckoning, unfortunately, will be quite painful, but we can postpone it.
Well, the trick is to promote the bubble and then get out before it bursts.
That's right.
But how can we even predict? I mean, you're talking about predicting, but John Kenneth Galbraith said there are two kinds of forecasters, those who don't know and those who don't know they don't know.
That's right. It is very, very hard to predict the timing of these bubbles and when they will burst. However, I think there is there's a significant commonality of events that usually transpire as the bubble is reaching unsustainable heights. Now, that's probably not very comforting to fund managers out there, because what I'm suggesting is we can know we're in a bubble and the prices can still rise for some period of time. However, if you have the patience and discipline, you can probably avoid that downward draft that follows these bubbles.
Now, Japan was in a bubble, although it didn't appear to be so in the 60s, 70s, 80s. There was a book in 2001 called The Coming Collapse of China.
Yep.
Is China in a bubble? Or can they just have sustainable growth and have it kind of peter out at a certain point? There is always a tipping point when you no longer are expanding at the kind of rate that China is expanding at right now.
Sure. So what I would say, Leonard, is that there are lots of signs that China is indeed bubbly. Whether it's set for a bursting of that bubble or not is not a question I'm prepared to answer. What I will say is the slowdown is virtually inevitable in China, that we will see that 8% economic growth rate that has been supporting a large complex of companies both inside and outside of China will slow to more like 5, 6% in the decades to come. When that happens, there will be bust-like ramifications in many sectors, in particular the commodity sectors that have been really fueling this Chinese voracious appetite for building will slow.
Well, they can have a real estate bubble burst even if they don't have other things burst. But what would that mean to us? Would that be a positive thing for the United States or a negative thing?
Well, on the margin, it would be a growth shock to the world economy, and that's not a good thing for U.S.
companies. Right now we're talking about what's happening in Japan, which was recovering and now is facing a major setback. Yep. But I am assuming that Japanese industry is going to grow at a very fast pace for a little while as part of the recovery.
Sure. There's always a rebound.
Good or bad?
That would be a good thing. The Japanese rebound is probably good on the margin for the world. A Chinese slowdown, I think, will be bad for the margin on the world, for the world on the margin. Here's a couple of different facts that one needs to consider. Number one, China is a disproportionate share of large commodities, whether it's copper or cotton or steel or iron ore, huge demand driver there. And if you take away that demand, even marginally, we will have significant overcapacity in iron ore mines in Brazil and Australia. The whole shipping sector has been designed to move this stuff around predominantly from Brazil, South Africa, and Australia to China. The yards, the shipyards that build these ships have been expanded to take into account the robust demand for ships because they're needing to move these commodities, which are needed for the Chinese infrastructure boom. Again, this whole sort of cycle unravels if we have a slowdown.
Now, China has has a near monopoly on rare earth minerals, and people are talking about a green energy bubble.
The green energy bubble is definitely something that is believable, right? Why? Number one, are we seeing more people get involved when prices go up? Yes, we are, because there's a belief, if oil prices are going up, green energy is going to be more valuable, so let's get more involved as it goes up in price. There is a new technology element to it where it is different this time, right? And so we're going to throw away our traditional valuation metrics because green energy is going to run the world. So there are definitely elements of green energy that are bubbly.
But so often it's belief in that technology will save us that fuels a bubble.
Yes, absolutely. It's definitely a belief that there's something different. This technology is unique and is going to save problems.
On the other hand, all of this has made a lot of people wary, and lots of money is flowing into U.S. Treasury bonds and municipal bonds because they're considered safe. Is there a potential for them to go bust? Can they?
Well, I think there's definitely some elements of bubbles, sort of, they're definitely bubbly as well. And can they go bust? Absolutely. I mean, with interest rates where they are today in the world, I think there's a asymmetric bet that one can make that they will rise more, like they are more likely to rise than they are to fall from this level, particularly on some of these bonds. If that were to occur, the value of these bonds will fall quite precipitously, which is a reason why I think there is probably a risk of a credit bust, if you will.
Well, we've talked about some states going bankrupt, like California. If that happens, will there be a domino effect? You suggested earlier that if China goes bust, there'll be a domino effect because globalization now connects us all. Does that happen on a local level in the United States as well?
Absolutely. That risk is very real. And what I will do is point you to another analogy from the book, which is what happened in the Asian financial crisis. Here, Thailand had some major issues, some bank defaults, and started having some real problems. Within a couple of months, we had problems in the Philippines, et cetera, as money was flying out the door. Why was that? Well, one of the reasons why that happened was that we had this new innovation of emerging markets funds. And so these emerging market fund managers had exposure to all of these countries. And when Thailand went bust, they suddenly found themselves overweighted elsewhere. And likewise, municipal fund managers will find themselves scrambling to raise money.
And when Ireland, when Iceland had problems, England suffered.
And Norway and others. That's right.
So we're in trouble right now, aren't we, Vikram?
I'm not exactly an optimist when it comes to today's financial outlook.
I'm putting right my money under the mattress.
You know, unfortunately, there are times when that's a rational decision. I do actually think there are places that are not so bubbly that could be interesting to allocate capital to. And there are areas that I think on a longer-term view I'm slightly more bullish about. I'm very bullish when it comes to energy and energy, specifically transportation. Related energy, and that means oil predominantly.
Oil is still, for a while, a place where you'll make some money. Eventually, I guess.
Well, it's I have no ability to judge whether we'll make money today or tomorrow or the day after, but I can tell you that oil seems to be something that will be a valued commodity in the world as it progresses.
Until it runs out anyway. Vikram Mancharamani's book, Boom Bustology, Spotting Financial Bubbles Before They Burst, is published by Wiley. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me.